I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome into this special edition of the Arkham Files. Thank you for joining us. We're doing something different than our standard actual play session, and changing things up for this episode. We had the singular opportunity to spend over an hour having a conversation with a very special guest, and a legend in the gaming industry. It was one of the coolest conversations all of us have ever had, and we are sharing that conversation with you. You didn't ask, but before we get into it, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this conversation came to be. We recently played our very first Dungeons & Dragons crossover session, which we will be releasing to all of you soon. But since we are a Call of Cthulhu podcast, we had to play D&D with a mythos twist. Stay tuned for that session. It was a ton of fun, and we will be releasing those episodes within the next couple of weeks. I'll leave his full intro for the conversation. But in addition to a huge list of other accomplishments, our guest wrote and published the Cthulhu Mythos adaptation for Dungeons & Dragons 5e that we use for our session. So in the lead up to the release of our D&D session, we asked him to come on and talk about that product. And as a bonus, he was gracious enough to talk to us about a ton of other topics too. So without further nonsense from me, I'll let Alex take it away and introduce our guest for this special episode of the Arkham Files.
Welcome, everybody, to the Arkham Files. Thanks for joining us. We are your favorite actual play Call of Cthulhu podcast, but today we got something a little different coming for you. We're not playing a game today because we are fortunate, incredibly fortunate to have a very special guest. Our guest today, he got his start in the gaming industry with Chaosium in 1980. He is the primary creator of the game we all know and love, The Call of Cthulhu. Even if that was the only thing he ever did, it would put him in the top tier of game creators of all time. But the list goes on. He worked on RuneQuest and Stormbringer for Chaosium. He also wrote Ghostbusters, the RPG, with Greg Stafford. And I'm still just talking about his work in the 80s. So moving on from there, he got into the video game industry where he worked on some of the greatest and most influential works of all time. I'm talking about games like Doom and most of the Doom series, Quake, Civilization, Halo Wars, and last but not least, the Age of Empires series. And finally, in 2013, he founded Peterson Games, creating and releasing a lot of other great games like the highly acclaimed Cthulhu Wars. And finally, the primary subject of why we asked him on today, the Sandy Peterson's Cthulhu Mythos for 5e, which we recently used to play a session and which is soon to be released also. So stay tuned for that and loved. And if you haven't guessed it already, I am, of course, talking about the gaming legend, the man behind the mythos, Mr. Sandy Peterson himself. Sandy, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for making the time and hanging out with us here on the Arkham Files.
I am happy to be here. I suspect that that your audience figured out it was me when you said that I authored Sandy Peterson's Cthulhu Mythos for 5e.
Yeah, that's a pretty good clue. A little bit of a giveaway. Yeah.
We're about to release the second edition for Pathfinder of that book. Mm. And because we did a Pathfinder one too, as well as the 5e, right? But And we just released Skin Deep, which is a 280-page campaign.
Wow.
including the Sand Dwellers, which are like a justly neglected monster, but I tried to make them scary for this.
That's good. I would like to see them get the neglect or the spotlight for once and hopefully turn them into something.
Exactly, because I actually have a video on my YouTube channel, which anyone curious, it's Sandy of Cthulhu, no breaks, about the Sand Dwellers and why they are so lame and how I try to make it.
Well, if anybody can do it, it's you.
Well, you'd have to look at Skin Deep to see if I succeeded, but it starts out with Jack the Ripper style killings and ends in the violent dimension and all kinds of crazy things. But
Awesome. Is that upcoming?
You guys
upcoming?
Also play Call of Cthulhu. Sorry, I admit I haven't listened to your podcast, but
we haven't listened to it either. we primarily play Call of Cthulhu, and this was actually the very first time we played D&D. This was our first foray into D&D for our show, and actually for most of the guys in the group. And so we figured, hey, we're a Call of Cthulhu show. If we're going to try out D&D, we should do some Call of Cthulhu D&D. So, your book had been on my radar for a while. You know, I've had it. I bought the PDF, and so it's been something I've been wanting to run. So I was like, hey, if we're going to be branching out, trying anything new, then this has got to be the ticket right here.
The two things I am most proud of in that book, and if you've read it, you may know this, are the way that I display the great old ones and the outer gods, which is as environmental effects that intensify over time. Which I think that's a really cool way. So when Cthulhu's there, it's not just, it's Godzilla, let's shoot him. It's more like at first, like the angles start going wrong, and then there's the telepathy making you hallucinate, and then things start creeping out of portals, and and eventually it goes to the point where if you try to run away, you go in a circle because all the angles are wrong and that kind of thing. But other thing I'm really proud of is my explanation of how the cults work.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, I assume not you guys, get the cults a little bit wrong. They make them like regular cults that are like, they're fanatics, but they don't really, Cthulhu's cults don't really have a theology, right? They're fundamentally atheist.
Right.
They're all in it for what they are going to get right now. Almost more like the Elks Club than like an evil Elks Club.
Yeah.
than a real religion. But anyway.
So also, there you go, guys. Pro tip right here. All your cults should be like an evil Elks Club or like the Shriners.
That's why they have the antlers and stuff, right?
Right. and that actually was something
else. You're in Utah, and I come up to Utah periodically. So we should get together on one of these times.
Oh, absolutely.
That would be amazing.
I can get you guys to play my Terror Paths game.
Anytime you are free, we will drop everything we have.
I will quit my job and everything.
Well, usually my hangouts are in Utah Valley, Spanish Fork, Provo, that area, because that's where the grandkids and and my parents live.
Wherever that's where we will be.
The granddaughters, right?
We're not too far. I work, Seth and I both work in Utah Valley. And so, it's not too far at all. And again, definitely worth the trip. So we will be there.
Yeah. I'm down in the Moab area, but that's basically there.
Well, I have to drive to get there. Right.
Right.
In fact, I had a family reunion in Moab, a couple of years ago. We were playing my games.
Oh, nice.
That's awesome.
Kids like my games. And so
We'll have to make it another family.
Propagandized by me to think they're good.
Well, as long as we can stop at the BYU Creamery, I'm in for whatever you want to do.
Oh yeah, Orange Cremo, boy, that's the thing that you can't get outside Utah.
Oh man,
no, you can't.
That's what we live for. It's in our veins.
As great as Bluebell and Blue Bunny ice cream are here in Texas, they don't have Orange Cremo.
Right. Yeah, no. It's all orange stuff for us. Orange Cremo and fry sauce running in our veins up here in Utah.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I was at the Gen Con convention, which, as you know, there's a big Kiosian presence and there's a Peterson Game presence too. And we went to a restaurant and they were serving on the menu. There was funeral potatoes and fry sauce. And we were like, what? And so we asked the waitress, is there a Utah connection here? Like, yeah, the chef was the forum. And everyone else in my company is like, what are funeral potatoes? I said, order them. You'll like it. You know, what's fry sauce? Don't worry about it. Just get it.
It's sauce chef for your walks fries. Out. Chef walks out in black pants and white button-up shirt, black tie, name tag.
The owner dropped by, but because we had a big table of, you know, the game guys, but that was also awesome because they had a they did a special thing for the fact that Gen Con was going on, the big, you know, biggest game convention in America, right? Mm-hmm. And so they had like pulled orc buns, right? And then they had dragon wings, three flavors, lawful, neutral, and chaotic. So that was
that's awesome. So
that was awesome. That was pretty great. And they also had Mountain Dew on tap. Yeah, on tap. So they were really going all out for, but the next year they got a new manager and he didn't want any of that kid stuff. So then they saw they did badly.
Mountain Dew will get those Mormons real hyped up.
So. Well, it's a gaming thing, right? Gamers, they, right. It's yeah, or Diet Coke, right? Or in Texas, Diet Dr. Pepper.
It's the lifeblood of the industry.
That's right.
That sounds like he hates fun.
Yeah, it's like you don't want Mountain Dew at a gaming convention.
That's the paradox of Call of Cthulhu, in that I always ran the game or play or all the everything I write for it, I do straight. Like it's this awful, terrifying experience. But then when I play it or I see people play it, everyone's laughing, having a good time. Some awful thing comes and sucks off another player's head, and there's like giggles, you know?
Yeah.
You have to play it straight for that to work, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's actually
a podcast then.
Yeah. That's something I'm the primary keeper for the show. And so, so that's what I try to do when I'm running the games, is that I have to try and play it as straight as possible, because these guys are the ones that are going to be trying to take it off the
rails. Oh yeah. My players are Looney Tunes too. Right. As you might imagine, they've grown long in the tooth playing my games. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say we run it off the rails pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that happens in my games. My usual technique is I set up problems for the players, and I don't bother with figuring out the solutions because that's their job, and then they have to figure out the solutions on their own to whatever problem I throw them. And
gotta make some notes.
That way, I get surprised. You know, they get surprised. Sometimes they think it's insoluble, and I said, you know. Well, it's called Cthulhu, you know. So sometimes Cthulhu eats the world.
Get a helmet.
But in fact, Call of Cthulhu kind of exists in a good way because of the idea of keeping it straight. Because what happened is, way back when in 1980, Chaosium got the license to do Lovecraft. At that time, Lovecraft wasn't public domain yet, right? Because it was 40 years ago, right? So they got the license. And then I found out they had the license and I wanted to do something with the game. So what happened? The thing is that in 1980, everyone hated Lovecraft. Okay. He was vanishingly obscure. Every single person I knew who had read Lovecraft had learned about him from me. And this might've been partly because I lived in Utah, right? But where they don't read a lot of horror stories, but you know, just people didn't read Lovecraft, and people that knew about books thought he was a terrible hack. So, Chaosium, everyone at Chaosium thought he was a terrible hack too. None of them had read him. Lovecraft is not an author you have to read to have an opinion about, right? So they just like, oh yeah, Lovecraft's terrible. But they knew I loved Lovecraft. And the thing is, what any lesser company would have done is they would have done the game themselves and been snarky about it. You know, kind of the way that like the first two Batman movies back in the 80s were good and the guy respected it. Then he goes on to like Batman and Robin and stuff. And the director, no one can take this seriously. I'll just make fun of it. Right. Yeah. And then all at once, the whole thing tanks and you have bat nipples and the bat credit card. Right. Same thing happened with the original Christopher Reeve Superman. First one's good. Then they started making fun of the genre because they thought no one respected it. Right. Well, Chaosium knew that if they did it, they wouldn't respect it and they'd be snarky and it wouldn't properly mimic Lovecraft because they couldn't take it seriously. But they said, Sandy loves it. He'll do it right. And they were humble enough to give it to me because they knew they'd screw it up. And of course, since then, they decided Lovecraft was cool after all, especially when it became like 85% of the sales. But, but it was a but I didn't know they didn't like Lovecraft. I assumed that who doesn't like Lovecraft? I was thinking, right. But they did not. And the three things that got me the job were that I loved Lovecraft. They do. I do a good job. Second, that I'd never missed a deadline. And the third, that I'd always delivered on the few other projects I'd done. So those are, I didn't know that at the time. That's what they told me afterwards.
Right.
Your resume is pretty okay. I'll say so myself. Yeah.
It's not too shabby.
Stuff was serendipitous. I don't know if you've heard the story of how the sanity system came to be.
But, no, I haven't.
Yeah. Love to hear it. I was trying to think of a way to make the monsters even scarier. And I knew that Lovecraft's guys are always fainting dead away and going mad. And so I worked up the sanity system. And my idea was that it would be just kind of another weapon the monsters used. They have tentacles and they have spells and they can blast your mind. Right. But I didn't realize the ramifications of this. So the very first time I tested this system, this wasn't actually in California. When I was going to grad school there. And so I played it and the characters are playing the haunted house scenario. You've all played it, right? The Corbett house.
Yeah.
So with the killer bed upstairs. So they go into that and they're trying to figure out what's haunting the house and they find a book. And the book says, has a spell, how to summon malign being from beyond. And they still not talk themselves into thinking that this was the thing haunting the house, but it was like a dimensional shambler, right? So they get in the basement and they said, we want to cast a spell. And I said, well, you got to have black cat's heads and bottles of holy water. And what I just made up stuff. And they, cause I didn't have a, so they're casting the spell. And I say, you hear a sound in the air, it starts to tear apart. Something's coming through. And at this point, the player said, I cover my eyes. I run in the corner and hide my face. I'm running upstairs. And until that moment, I didn't realize that the sanity rules would make players behave as though their characters were actually afraid. And that's when I knew I was onto something. I mean, it was, I guess you could say I lucked out, but I really recognized how good that was. I said, oh, they're acting afraid. And you don't have that in most games unless the players like are really doing a good job on the character, which in 1980 no one was, right? We were all doing games, but the sanity system made people act afraid and be cautious about going somewhere. What if there's something really bad and I see it, it'll go crazy. You'd never have that happen in D&D. You'd want to go see what the monster is. Well, I mean, of course, D&D 5e, I mean, my Cool Mythos has that kind of effect, but I had to put rules in for it, you know? Right. So anyway, that was quite fortunate. And that, you know, kind of became the sign of Call of Cthulhu that you guys
can kind of say. The hallmark of the game.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that we experienced because Mr. Corbett was the very first scenario that we ran.
It's actually a different Mr. Corbett that we ran. We ran the Mr. Corbett from Mansions of Madness. It is the very first scenario on our podcast. This one, the current one's called The Haunting, which I run.
It's now called The Haunting, not The Haunted House.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's no longer in the core rule book. I said it was in one of my casts, but apparently it's been moved out of there, but it's still available.
Yeah. I think they have it for free on the website and the quick start rules. That's one question I had about, so the mythos for 5e you're talking about, so moving all the sanity mechanics and the sanity rules over into the D&D rules, was that a challenge?
Well, I will be, brutally frank. My job on the 5e was not to know the 5e rules, but to know the lore. And I did all the background stuff. I said, here is how Egolanak works. Okay, this is how Glocky works. This is how the cult of Shub-Niggurath operates. And then I had a guy who knew 5e like the back of his hand, and he put in the rules to make it work that way. And then I read them afterwards.
Okay. That's cool.
To look for any red flags. And if I saw him, I'd ask him, how does this work? And he'd explain, and I go, okay, that's good. Or, you know, that's bad. We got to do it a different way. So I actually, so it may have been incredibly hard to adapt it to 5e, but he didn't complain to me. So I'm going to assume that it was really easy and that I vastly overpaid him.
Well, he did a great job. So the mechanics in there are
awesome. Multiple guys. There was editors that came in afterwards. It was vetted a bunch to make sure that it was right, you know. Yeah. I do know that the sanity rules in 5e are more arduous to run than they are in Call of Cthulhu. I think because just the native having character classes and levels and stuff and saving throws just made it more awkward to fit in the sanity rules.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty simple in Call of Cthulhu. You just roll the 100 and then lose some sanity and see if it's enough to make you become an NPC.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing with 5e is it's just, you know, it's crunchy. D&D is more crunchy. So
I think it's easier to be really horrifying with a smoother running system.
That is true. And I guess that's one thing is
you can do it in D&D, obviously, but you know.
Right. And that's one thing I did actually want to ask you about is you have the whole first part of the book that's talking about how to use the book really and how to run horror in heroic fantasy. And you know, you have your various tips in there, like the basic rules for horror, which I think are awesome. And in this section too, you mention how when you tend to add other genre elements into horror, it tends to always flip it more into whatever that new genre is. And so that was one thing I wanted to dive a little deeper on. Do you have any tips on that? How do you prevent that from happening? How do you add in other genre elements, but still maintain it as being primarily horror?
It can be tough. The main one that is a danger to most players is turning it into an action movie because they're unlikely to turn it into a rom-com, right?
Right.
or a buddy movie. I mean, I guess they could. But usually it's action is the problem because they start having a running fight with a bunch of chochos. And then instead of being horrified by the terrible things of the chochos, you are having this awesome running fight. And that can be fun. And that, you know, so maybe that's okay to have an occasional action sequence. Certainly there are horror movies which nonetheless have action. For example, Phantasm 2, if you've seen that. There's a pretty hefty action scene in a mortuary in there. Have any of you seen it?
I haven't.
Put it on the list. Okay, maybe that's a bad example. What do you think?
Looking at it right now.
Donovan's gonna watch.
I'm not watching.
Be an hour and a half. We can come back an hour. Okay, it doesn't matter. Right. Anyway, the point is there's an action scene, but it starts in horror. There's the action that goes back into horror. And I think the best way to do it, the way I've found, is that before I'm about to run an adventure, then I think in my head some cool scenes I want to have happen in that adventure. And these scenes could be from a movie or a book or just something I had in a dream or just made up, some scene, some confrontation or horrific thing. And then as the adventure goes by, I plop those in, you know, the players open the bedroom and they find the hideously distorted corpse of something like from the movie, The Thing, right? Or whatever your thing is. And then checkpoints, as it were, usually bring the players back into like, oh, this is creepy, this is horror, you know. Also, if you throw them things that make them think and worry and have to puzzle it out, then that puts them back into the horror mode instead of let's pull out a gun. I'm not saying it's wrong to pull out a gun every time, right? It's just there's a lot of monsters in Call of Cthulhu that don't really care if you pull out a gun. Here's an example. So one of the a game I ran way back, I stole a scene from the movie, of all things, I Married a Monster from Outer Space. I don't know if any of you have seen this movie, but it's literally what it sounds like. Aliens come to town and they replace all the men. And so they can, like, I guess, have babies with the women or something. Anyway, there's a scene in it where this alien goes out on the balcony after his wedding night. And and he looks like a dude, right? But he's standing there, and suddenly there's a flash of lightning, and for a second you can see the hideous Rugos alien face underneath, and they're very alien. Like, you can't see where the mouth is or anything. There's like tubes on it. And you're like, whoa, that was a shock. So what I did in my game, the players found out that something terrible was happening up at the old castle, and they go into the village and they say, we've got to go stop the things at the castle, these terrible things. So the villagers said, yeah. So they're all trooping up the road with like rakes and torches and, you know, stuff. And the players are like, yeah, we're going to do this. And then there's a flash of lightning. And I took the players aside and I said, when lightning flashes, you see that the faces of the villagers are hideously distorted monsters. And only when the lightning flashes. And she said, am I sure? Am I going insane? And then the players are like, started to talk to each other. And they were like, are they monsters? Do they know they're monsters? Have they always been monsters? Are they going to get us? Like, what's going on here? And basically the session went from the big action, everyone going over to burn the castle and kill the monster, into the players trying to figure out how to get out of this march on the castle, because they no longer knew what was happening. And even when they escaped, they had to figure out what to do about the village. Is the village really all monsters? And it was, and the mystery there, combined with the horror of all these guys we know might be monsters, was effective in my game with my players. Mm-hmm. Obviously your players, everyone's players are different, but that worked for me.
Right.
You know, there's also the time that the players were searching through their house that was haunted. Right. And they opened a closet and found one of them tied up and gagged. But it was one of the people that found it was that same guy. So there was like two of him. And then that was kind of a problem for them to solve. And they kind of went from, let's make sure the house is safe and then go kill the monster, to is which one of us is real?
Right.
You know, like the thing or something. So,
yeah, exactly.
So that's my thing. Awesome. I have a scene that breaks the action flow in a sense. It's okay to have a little, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just go ahead and have a lot of it just because it's fine to have a giant gun battle once in a while. But because you can't stay terrified throughout the whole length of it. That's why movies have comic relief. That's why, you know, I mean, you simply can't do it. I learned this, of all things, when I was first watching King Kong, the original King Kong from the 30s, and I'm watching it, and there's this long chase scene through the swamp where they're being eaten by dinosaurs, and everything's going wrong. They're dropping like flies. And I noticed that partway through it, it's pretty scary, really, even by modern standards. Every one of these people being killed by monsters, the people start to laugh. And it's because it's like 15 minutes of unrelenting people being killed, and you just can't be scared for that long. You have to... Right. You have to respond to it in some way. So it's okay. That's why the jokes my players have, or that your players have, or an occasional action scene is okay as a release, but you have to make sure to go back into the horror. So for example, Alien is a horror movie, right? And Aliens is an action movie with horror elements.
Right.
And I think most competing horror games like Chill and the like were action things with horror elements, which is why Call of Cthulhu survived them. Also, Call of Cthulhu was super contrarian, as you know. I mean, you don't get an EP, XP. You get worse as time goes on. Your big prize is a moldy old book that makes you go crazy by looking at the pictures. you know, when you get a new magic power, you're worried, and the other guys start getting their guns loaded instead of being happy for you.
Yeah.
I can read your mind now. No one wants you to read their mind.
and speaking of Chaosium, back in the early days where you were saying they kind of gave you the trust and the faith to let you run with this stuff, was there any of these things when they started looking at this game that made them have some second thoughts, being like, hey, whoa, hold on, no XP, everybody's going crazy, where are we going with this?
I think we all thought that it was going to they did make me adjust the sanity rules in the very original first draft of it, which I probably would change it myself. Then you actually couldn't ever recover any sanity. And you just only went down until you died. They had me put in a way to get sanity back, but as you know, it's generally a death spiral, right? I mean,
right,
you lose more sanity than you get back. Right.
And it, like you said, it absolutely affects the way that the players play the game as they go forward. I mean, in our most recent, season or scenario, we have a series of linked scenarios through our show.
Is this the Santa Fe thing or?
That's actually kind of a one-off one shot. It's the, the Fall of New Jerusalem is our more in our main campaign. But yeah, so Seth's character is running really low on sanity and it completely changed the way that he played through that whole scenario.
Well, yeah, he seems shaky, right? And presumably that's what's going on with the actual character Seth's playing, is that now his nerves are shot. He's had a nervous breakdown. He's like, he can't take it, you know, and he's likely to go into hysterics, and he may do it before he sees the monster just to keep himself alive. So it's very.
Great. I mean, it even
that's how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, there's this element of I'm being too trepidatious because I'm so nervous and afraid. And then the next minute I'm being way too over aggressive because I'm kind of losing it.
Yeah. So the sanity rules, I think, help keep you, help remind you in Call of Cthulhu that it's a horror game, because like you're unlikely to go take your machine gun and go shooting a whole bunch of deep ones, just because just seeing the loathsome flopping horde of deep ones is going to be like hammering you with sand loss. And you know, no matter how much the game master tries to mitigate it, it's still going to be troublesome.
Yeah, that's one aspect of the game that I really love, is the sanity, and just that it's set in like a modern world. It definitely made me like adjust how I play the game, because it made me kind of evaluate, like, if I myself were really in this scenario, in this situation, how would I really react if I were seeing something like that, you know? And so it definitely adds a cool aspect to the game.
Well, and you actually lose, I mean, it's a simulation, but you lose sanity as you go, because you don't want to lose more sanity. And so, like Alex said, you're more trepidatious about, I don't want to go into this scenario because I'm going to lose more sanity. And if I do that, I'm going to lose control of my character. And if I'm lucky, that means he's going to run in the opposite direction. And so it builds in the effect that you want to have. So the characters or the players themselves have to adjust the way they play to reflect the system of the game. It's brilliant. And it's a ton of fun to play that way.
You guys make fun of me for sitting in a diner to heal up because I just got eaten by a deadlight.
I know, I got to give you some credit there. I'm a little afraid to play my main character now because his sanity is getting so low. He's going to go crazy.
Well, as I'm good sure thing, Alex I'm a will back me up as a keeper, it also is a super awesome tool to herd the players into or out of things that you want them to do. Just say, you know, they'll say, well, I'm going to shoot the postmaster because I'm pretty sure he's a zombie. And then you say, oh, you shot this person. Looks like he's a normal guy. Lose a D6 sanity. And then, you know, it's a.
Yeah, it really is. It's an awesome mechanic. Yeah. As a keeper to control the flow of the game and, you know, not necessarily want to railroad, but to kind of guide some direction.
No, you don't have to rail. No, you don't. I don't want to railroad my guys. Like I said, I don't even know how they're going to get out of the scenario. Right.
Yeah. But, which I love that you said that, because that's also one of my biggest epiphanies I had when, as just my experience as a game master, was that exact one you said, where I make problems and you guys make solutions.
Yeah. Well, I think I do think it takes some experience as a game master to reach that point, and also as players to reach that point, because I've gone to conventions and tried that technique, and the players are waiting for me to give them a hint as to where to go. And I don't have a hint for them. I want them to figure it out, you know, and they're like, okay, I'm going to sniff the fried chicken containers. I said, smells like, you know, like Kentucky Fried, you know, and I'm going to look under behind the thing. And I say, okay, there is nothing more of value to be found here. Yeah. They're trying to figure things out. And instead of trying to figure them out, sometimes they are trying to get me to give them it, to tell them, because that's what they're used to in their campaign.
Right.
And, which is why the scenario, like scenario packs, are still useful, because they, you know, they enable even a newer keeper to be able to handle things. And of course, an advanced keeper knows how to bypass or utilize the things in the back, right? So this just makes the job easier.
Right.
I mean, I'll spend some time preparing a scenario, whether it's all from scratch or it's one of my published things. If it's published, I just build on top of it, you know.
I had a question about that.
That was, go ahead.
You mentioned like when you run games and you've got these pre-published scenario packs, which are perfect for new keepers and new game masters or whatever. For you personally, when you run games, do you ever use pre-published scenarios at this point to see, hey, I want to see how this, or do you mostly just, you know, go with it and write your own exclusive?
The problem is my handicap is that I'm Sandy Peterson. And so everyone expects that I have to run my own stuff. And if I run someone else's, they're kind of like, oh, okay, that's nice. You know, and then I feel guilty. So I pretty much have to run my own stuff. And so I've put together I write a scenario or two a year for drone at conventions that I go to, and I play that scenario. And then actually the Peterson's Abominations book published by Chaosium, it has seven of these scenarios that I did at conventions. Cause I'd play them at five or six conventions. And then I figured once I start going to the first convention again, cause it was next year, then I guess that one's used up. So I just put these into the Peterson's Abominations. So you can kind of see what my scenarios are like in there. But I have a bunch that weren't that haven't been used yet that I might still publish.
Do you ever get to be a player? I'm sure everybody always.
I almost never ever get to be a player. Occasionally, I'm a game because everyone says you're Sandy Peterson. You must be the best game master, which I'm of course not. There's plenty of keepers who are better than me. Being a game designer and being a game master are not a completely overlapping set of skills, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes someone who's renowned in his ability to play will get me in. Often they're sorry because I spend so much time being a game master that I don't always know how to be a good player, because if I get a hint that something here is going to lead to something really disastrous, then I'll generally want to go ferret out the disastrous thing to see what's happening and entertain myself. Yeah. Also, because I hardly ever am a player, I know my guy is not long for this world. I mean, it's going to be this scenario. And then I probably won't use that guy again. So I don't have any, like Sam, you said, is afraid that his main character will get killed. I never have that fear. So yeah. I may not be the most fun guy to play along with because I get you into trouble, but maybe that makes it more fun, right?
Hey, to me, that's fun. Yeah,
that is Alex all day, dude. And it's so annoying. Whenever I run a game, he knows exactly what I'm going to do, and he just exploits it and then kills everybody.
Yeah, the last scenario, Alex killed me and our other brother that's not on the call right now. He turned on us.
I think maybe that is an aspect of being a game master that never gets to be a player. When you do get to be a player, it's
well, no, that hard. And you got so this ring of down. Power.
My team of players, I've been playing with most of them for 28 years.
Wow.
So they know me extremely well, and I have to keep on my toes to surprise them. On the other hand, I know them really well.
Yeah.
So I know what will surprise them. The most recent addition to our group has only been there for 21 years.
Oh, okay. So the rookie, you're probably still hazing him.
What a noob.
He's actually my best friend now. But
yeah, that's awesome. I guess you're so being in those times you have gotten to be a player. So who would you say is who's a game master that stands out to you that you've played with as being some of the best?
There was this Italian guy when I went to the Lucca convention in 2012 that was just amazeballs. I really, really liked what he did. I tragically cannot remember his name, but he was dressed in an Italian World War II era fascist police uniform, which also impressed me. He had a whole bunch of guys. They were just like Sam Spade and flappers. And he happened to be in the fascist police. Right. But I mean, he wasn't a fascist. He just like, that was part of his costume. And that was a really good adventure. There was fun guys from Yuggoth and a radio program that was alerting them and all kinds of good things. So that was, he may have been one of the best keepers I ever played under.
That's awesome.
Greg Stafford ran Call of Cthulhu a couple times. He was really good.
Mm-hmm.
very creative, had no idea what the rules were of Call of Cthulhu. he just played the game, you know. So those are some really good ones.
I got a question for you, Sandy. Who wrote The Lightless Beacon? Because that was the one that was released for Greg Stafford. Greg Stafford Day. I can't remember.
Is that a new scenario from Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah, it's pretty recent over the last
couple of years. Oh, I have no idea. I mean, I own 1% of Chaosium.
Yeah.
Because they bought me out except for 1% because they wanted me to always have a stake in Chaosium. But I'm not actually privy to what they're. I know what big things they're working on coming up, right? And that kind of thing, but I don't know all their authors stable. I don't think is Lightless speaking Mike Mason?
I think it might be.
He's
actually
like their top guy. Mike Mason or Paul Frick?
Carr. Yeah.
Who?
Leigh Carr with Lynn Hardy.
Oh, Lynn Hardy, yeah, she's really good.
Yeah, that was a fun scenario.
I've played a lot with her. She's an amazing game master. Also, Ian Livingston from Australia is super good. Mm-hmm. Actually, Mike Mason and Paul Frick are, I don't know if they're running games anymore, but when they were part of the Cabal of Keepers organization, before he became working for Chaosium as the main editor, they did some really good. They would do things like they would have a game and there'd be two separate rooms they'd be playing it in that were different, that were in different dimensions. And players would periodically fall through holes into the other group where there was people that were like the people they knew, but not identical. And you had to figure out how to go back and forth between them. That was like two parallel universe Call of Cthulhu games going on at the same time. That was insane. Like extreme keepering.
That's
really cool.
That is kind of a question that I had, and you kind of already answered it, but in your mind, what's a couple of attributes to you that make a really great keeper? Is it creativity? Is it, you know, immersion for the players, or what is it to you that are a couple of things?
I think that it is different for different keepers because different people have different strengths, and also because the players you're playing for are different. I remember I played this scenario in England, and it was a haunted house kind of thing, like 80% of Call of Cthulhu adventures, you know, and they were really scared. I mean, they were actually not shaking, but they were acting like the players were acting very frightened about what was going on. You know, like one person dropped some keys and I said, the keys animate and scutter under the bed. And they were just freaked out. So I said, that was a great scenario. So I took it back to California and played it for my team there. And it just went over like a lead balloon. So the players had a lot to do with it. And I think different players, I think one of the great game masters I knew was, as Larry D'Attilio, sadly now passed away, he was really good at doing dialects. So that when he was doing character, I can't do that so well. When he was doing a character, you could tell which character he was doing, right? I think the two major things about being a good keeper are being able to think on your feet. I think creativity is obviously part of it. You know, that also helps if you have a pre-done scenario, you can kind of go through it. And the third thing I think is that you are sensitive to what you're always keeping a pulse on what the players are doing and thinking and feeling. So for example, when I had the keys fall and skitter, they were already being kind of nervous, but they hadn't seen anything overtly supernatural yet. And I thought, and I said, this is going to be the thing that sets them over the edge. And it did. I would also say I'm going to plug a friend of mine, Seth Skorkowski's YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. We're buddies now. He comes to my house and we watch movies and play games, and he has some really good advice on keepering too. At much greater length than I can do in this podcast.
Right. Yeah, I've watched a bunch of his videos. He's got some really great content and good advice. I like
a lot of us more generic game master stuff, but some of us specific. But going back to repeat, think on your feet, be creative, and be sensitive to the players and what they're feeling and doing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Cool.
Definitely makes sense.
Pro tip there, guys. And that's, I guess, kind of related to that. And you mentioned Larry DiTilio and some of these other guys. So, I mean, you know, you're being a guy that's created these games that are, you know, legendary at this point and some of the biggest games of all time. You're a game designer, a creator that most all of us look up to, all the modern guys and, you know, looks up to. Is who's somebody in the industry or somebody that you work with? I mean, you've worked with Greg Stafford, Sid Meier, John Romero, you know, Larry DiTilio. Throughout your career, is there somebody that was somebody that inspired you that you really looked up to as a game designer or just in general?
I really, really liked, he wasn't the game designer. He was the owner of the Ensemble Studios, Tony Goodman. Mm-hmm. He was an amazing leader of the company, and he had some weird ideas. One of them was that you never had to compromise because the two different sides, and not for the usual reason, they could always come to an agreement where both people were happy. And I'm not sure he was actually correct in that assumption, but he worked really hard for that all the time to get both sides to be happy. And he did it more often than I would have thought possible. So that kind of attitude towards things really impressed me. Sid Meier was an amazing game designer. I really liked working with him. Janelle Jakeways has a real eye for making things fun. I haven't worked with her much since that time, but you know, whatever. She moved out of state. But she was really, really good at that. And Lawrence Schick became one of my best friends working at MicroProse Software, so much so that one of my son's middle names is Lawrence after him. So he really had an eye for the making games fun and doable. So those are some guys I work with that I really respect.
Cool. That's amazing.
I actually met Shigeru Miyamoto once and,
oh, really?
I was so tongue-tied that I said something like super lame, like I'm a game designer too, and shook his hand. And I didn't want to wash my hand. I did, but I didn't want to. And I was just so impressed by meeting him because I mean, the guy that pushed Pikmin through a giant company, that guy, he clangs when he walks. Cause no company would have ever wanted Pikmin, you know? And he did it. So I'm like, plus he's done so many other things. Right. But,
right.
So he was kind of like a guy I was really impressed by.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, not to sound even lamer, but who is that?
Have you not played Super Mario or Zelda?
Oh my gosh.
Come on, Donovan.
Shigeru Miyamoto. He's like, he did all the stuff for Nintendo.
I was asking for Pete. I wasn't asking.
No, you were. My son dressed up as him for school one day. They had to do a thing where you picked a great innovator and you dressed up as them, and like it was a history lesson. But he dressed up as him and went to school as Shigeru Miyamoto. So
he's a great innovator, no doubt about it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's it. We need a new Donovan on our show.
Japanese guy, right? He was polite and bowed like a Japanese. He didn't look exceptional, except knowing who he is, he radiated You know,
that's amazing. I wouldn't. Well, there you go, Pete. Wanted to wash my hand either. Yeah. I would have been in the same boat.
And it's kind of funny that, like, I mean, obviously, like, that these game designers that they all of them have become such big names and kind of these celebrities. I mean, yourself included, obviously. But something you got in right at the beginning of all this, of really kind of the nascent game industry here. Like, what was that, getting into it at the beginning? And you're pretty young when you jumped off.
Board games or role playing games or computer games?
Yeah, role playing games.
Role playing games.
Yeah.
It was very much the Wild West. Everyone liked each other, except for Dave Casciano, whom everyone hated. And
take a note.
And everyone, he was reprehensible. There's many stories about Dave Casciano, but
he'll be the villain in our next series.
We were friendly to each other. We tried to work together and come up with clever ideas. And you could do a role playing game out of some crazy idea that you just had, like, in the bathtub, and then put it in a Ziploc bag and sell it at a convention and sell a couple thousand copies. It was just, like, incredible. And the art, well, you've seen the original D&D art, how terrible it was.
Yeah.
Everyone had Call of Cthulhu was amazing because we actually had good art, better than the original RuneQuest art. Call of Cthulhu got Gene Day, a noted science or comic artist, to do the stuff. So that's one of the features that I'm always proud of with the Call of Cthulhu, and actually my other games I've done, is that we always had good art. And I've tried to focus on that a lot. For example, I don't know if any of you guys have played the Age of Empires series, but Age of Empires is a real-time strategy game. So it's about little tiny armies running around shooting each other. So we do Age of Empires 3, which has musketeers, you know, and so it's not like super sexy, but we liked it. And what we did is we had the goal that we were going to win the prize for best graphics at E3 with a art. And of course, it's always shooters that get the best graphics, right? Shooters always got the best graphics because RTS just, there's too many guys on the screen at once and you couldn't get best graphics in RTS. And we said we were going to do it. And we did, you know, because there, people were looking at it and we'd have cannons firing and the houses would be flying apart and people would be setting things would burn down and the musketeers would line up and fire volleys. And it just looked so good. You have Indians shooting fire arrows into the huts, that we did it. And I was very, very proud of that. Obviously, I didn't do the art, but I was trying to do that. And if you've seen my newer games, like Cthulhu Wars or Planet Apocalypse or those things, you can see that I have kept up the feel, because I think that if you have a really amazing art in the game or in the materials, that it can help draw the players into it more, especially if the art is evocative, not giving away secrets, but like, this is what's going on. Look, don't you want to know more about this? Shadowy things with tentacles and whatever. So, so I think that's something that I found really useful. And that's actually one of the major troubles I have with doing Zoom role-playing, which I have done nonetheless, because, you know, the Black Plague is spread across the world, but I don't have a table full of figures to move things around, and I see the players getting scared and trying to, like, not be the guy in the front, and you know, and then I'll pull out some awful thing, you know, like my I have some really terrifying miniatures in my storage, and I'll pull one of these things out, and then they just, like, their hearts sink, and I say, well, it doesn't really look like this because it has, like, more tentacles and stuff, but it's symbolic of what it's like.
Kind of like this, but way worse.
Yeah.
And that was something I was going to point out, and specifically in the Cthulhu Mythos 5e book, is the artwork is just gorgeous. I love it. And
I funded it. And insisted on having good art and, like.
Right. Well, and, you know, and your love for the quality and your love for the source material, obviously, like, that really comes through in the book. And the fact that, and, you know, I was going to, I mean, all the products I have gotten, I've got two more books. I bought your guys' Shelf Breaker deal you just did, because that was incredible.
Cool. Thank you.
So I got the whole thing and I'm just, like, geeking out so bad over these books, because they're, once I got, you know, I saw
the art's fabulous, like, right?
Oh,
the characters phenomenal. Are so good. You can be a Zug. How cool is that?
Right.
Was anyone a Zug in your game that you ran?
No, we didn't play the Zug. That is one of our favorite things, were the races. But one of our definite highlights was, Sam played the cat.
Yeah, I got to play the cat.
The cat was a cat, not like You know, not like a super cat. It's a cat.
I know. And
yeah, I kept trying to act like I was a super cat, and Alex had to put me back on the rails. I was like, no, dude, you're literally just a house cat.
Yeah. You are
a cat. No, I mean, you're smart because it's three. Yeah. And then there's the ghouls who are like not wholly benign.
Yeah. Pete played the ghoul. Pete
played the ghouls.
And of course,
since Pete's always a contrarian, he had to play a ghoul bard because he had to be a disgusting thing that's supposed to be charming.
Yes, and no one wants to hang with the ghoul. Yeah.
I will admit,
for my fair lady, you know. Yeah. Well, I remember another feature of keeping the horror in gaming for Call of Cthulhu, and that is that I always play the monsters as malign.
Right.
And I've seen lots of Call of Cthulhu games where they decide that the Yithians or the fungi or some other race that's maybe not quite as evil as Cthulhu is, or the old ones are like okay to work with. And that, I think, moves direct, like at right angles away from the horror. And you have to keep those things, even if they're not evil in the earthly sense, it's going to be bad for humans to deal with the old ones. It's going to be bad for humans to deal with the Ithians, who, after all, literally exterminate entire species on a regular basis.
Right.
Right. And one of the things that I try to do is make sure that I kind of violated it a little bit with having the ghouls not just be evil, but Lovecraft did it first in Dreamquest. So
yeah, it's true. They are a kind of a little neutral at times in some of the mythos.
But they're always creepy. I mean, they're always looking to eat right. Randolph Carter and stuff. So
I did.
Your ghoul was the same way.
I did. At one point, we had to figure something out about what, you know, the antagonist was doing. And my solution was I ate some dead guy's brain so that I could get his memories. And
makes perfect sense.
You know, yeah.
Plus, if there's a ghoul in the party, then you never have to bury a dead party member.
Right.
I like that.
There you go. Yeah. And that also, that I do want to, that's such an awesome mechanic. In the book, that ability for the ghoul to get the memories of the corpse that he eats.
That was my idea.
Oh, that's
I got it from looking carefully at Pickman's model, which is the first Lovecraft story I ever read. I was eight. And the ghouls are cackling over the lore they're getting from going to the old graves. And I was thinking, what kind of lore are they getting from old graves? And over the years I said, it's not just getting like people's signet rings and stuff. They're getting something else. And so then I came up with they're getting memories, you know, they're learning, they're getting knowledge. And that made the ghouls, I think, scarier and more interesting.
The ghouls are
literally Homo sapiens.
That was one of the things I liked about the ghoul. Like you said, making the characters malign. And with the ghoul, like they're humanoid. I played a bard, obviously, which is ridiculous. But aspect, I just keep that in the
decaying finery.
That's actually exactly what he was.
Yeah.
Pull out your rapier and it's dripping with fungus.
Yeah, it's like you're in his head. You knew exactly how it went down. Yeah. That's phenomenal. But yeah, that was one of those.
Never wants to shelter on your shoulder.
Yeah, that's very true. The cat was a ton of fun. Sam was also just hilarious playing his cat.
Yeah,
which I had a ton of fun playing the cat.
Having a cat or a ghoul or a zoog is obviously on the face of it like hilarious, right? But to be fair, D&D is a more hilarious game than Call of Cthulhu. In a sense, if you go and play the cat in Call of Cthulhu, I think it would spoil the fun. But it makes it more fun.
So this might seem like a stupid question, but my question to you is, what do you like playing more, or what do you like better, D&D or Call of Cthulhu?
I know asking me if I like my own house rules better than someone else's rules.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know you're going to need to think about it hard.
I told Donovan not to ask that question.
I really haven't played D&D very much since 1979, when it kind of got replaced. Wow. Well, what happened is in 1973, when D&D first came out, I got a copy and played it with my friends. And we really liked it. And then what we would do is that was in the heyday of role-playing games. So every few months, some of the role-playing system was coming out. So we'd try out one of those. So we played D&D, and then we'd also play the fantasy trip. And then we go back to D&D. Then we play D&D. Then we play Traveler. Then we go back to D&D. Then we play D&D. Then we play D&D. Then we started playing RuneQuest. And then RuneQuest took over. We never went back to D&D because we liked RuneQuest so much. Right. And then RuneQuest, of course, is kind of an ancestor, sort of, or an uncle to Call of Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. So by the time Call of Cthulhu came along, I hadn't played D&D for a couple of years because I liked it. I actually went back and played old type D&D at a convention here in Texas, which was designed for old school guys. So they're playing original D&D, like from 1974. And I played it with them, and it was so dumb. Like, I just kept making fun of everything. And they were saying, oh, the princess needs to be rescued. And I said, I'm a hobbit, right? And they said, well, yeah. I said, I don't care about some human princess. Those guys suck. Take this money and do the ransom. I said, I say we take the money and go up into the hills and buy a boat and go somewhere else. And I didn't want to do anything on the quest, but
unless you got any hobbit babes back.
Some of that might have been the game master getting my goat. But
so I've got a question. When you were first getting started creating the Call of Cthulhu, did you ever imagine it would grow into what it is today?
No, I thought it was going to be a small cult game that if we were lucky, the 10,000 people who had ever heard of Lovecraft would play, and then it would go through one edition, maybe two, and then fade away. Because no one knew who Lovecraft was, so how could they be a fan of this game about him? Look at the title, right. Call of Cthulhu. I didn't want to call it that. Who heard of Cthulhu, right? Call it Nemesis or Dark Worlds. Those are the ideas we had coming up. But no, we're going to call it Cthulhu. It's people that know about Lovecraft know about it. And then instead of like being obscure, it actually spread Lovecraft's knowledge abroad. I mean, so many people have come to me and say, hey, I started reading Lovecraft because of your game.
Right.
You know, so in fact, I got an award at the Necronomicon Film Festival. It's a cool award. It's like a foot tall Wendy. Oh, she's not round. I'm going to take 1 second. You can talk about something else. I'll be right back.
No, you're good.
Absolutely. I would love to see this.
We agreed.
Yeah.
It's going to be rad.
Yeah. Sandy's stepping out to grab his award.
His award.
Never Necronomicon award.
I just called on my expensive trophy wife to
she was the award.
What? So my guess is it a lamp that looks like a leg?
So this award, what happened is that I went to the convention and they said, we're giving you an award. I said, great. Why? And they said, they'd given it to them at that time. I was the second one. This is the award.
Oh, that's sweet.
Isn't that nice?
Cool. That's awesome.
That's super cool.
Those who can't see it because you're listening to the podcast, it's Lovecraft. It's like a little bronze statue of Lovecraft. And it says the Howie Award for Lifetime Achievement. See Sandy Peterson, which is, of course, not my name, but whatever. I know it's. but what they said was that what happened in 1981, Call of Cthulhu came out, and knowledge of Call of Cthulhu started seeping throughout the hobby games crowd, right? I mean, by mid-1980s, everyone at TSR, the D&D company, they were exclusively playing Call of Cthulhu in their own games. They weren't playing D&D anymore. I know this by talking to them or them telling me, right? So then, of 1985, Reanimator comes out.
Right.
And then Stuart Gordon's movies, and then these start seeping through the film nerd culture. A knowledge of Lovecraft. And basically the argument that the Necronomicon guys made was that these two forces moving through pop culture is what made Lovecraft known. And now Cthulhu's a meme and everyone knows who Lovecraft is and
Right. Try
to cancel him and all that kind of stuff. So, so you know you're made when someone tries to cancel you.
Oh, yeah. So that's what we're waiting for.
So Lovecraft is known, and some of the credit, I'm proud to say, is me.
Yeah.
Though I didn't expect it. I didn't plan on it. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy it happened.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I'd for sure say that's true. I know that really my love for Lovecraft and Cthulhu came from the Call of Cthulhu game. And the funny thing is it started when I was a kid and I didn't even play the game as a kid. I just would see it around and it looked so interesting and cool to me.
Yeah,
that's cool. What made me start.
The bright colors and the tentacles and the Tom Sullivan art.
Go back to the artwork. Yeah. That artwork that draws you in.
Yeah, and that's really what drew me into Lovecraft in the first place, was just seeing these games and being like, what is this? I want to know more about it. And you know, when you're a kid, how most people, you pick up one of these game rules and it's basically Greek.
Well, I actually got into gaming that same way. I was 8 years old. My dad had a copy of the Gettysburg board game, and he lost the rules. So all I had was counters and a map of Gettysburg. And I would like pore over this for hours trying to figure out how it worked. And that kind of prepped me. So when I finally encountered actual tabletop games, besides like Clue and Stratego, that I was prepped to want to do with them. And then that playing those old war games led directly to, you know, Planet Apocalypse,
right,
and Halo Wars and Age of Empires.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's so cool. I kind of something you touched on just a second ago, you made it when you got canceled. is I guess that's something you've kind of been dealing with from the beginning. I was going to say that, you know, nowadays it seems like kind of a new thing for us, but you know, I guess back in the '80s, you had the Satanic Panic, you know,
The Satanic Panic, which fortunately for me mostly focused on D&D for some reason, because I guess they were too ignorant to know much about Call of Cthulhu.
Right.
But occasionally get a bye mention. I also got pretty hard canceled in the '90s with Doom.
With the
senators
with the,
Lieberman and Tipper Gore held up copies of Doom in Congress and denounced me. So that was pretty great.
Wow.
It that's, was weird that like it was Democrats denouncing me too, not Republicans. So it was like, okay, whatever. I guess they want the nanny state or something. But the Satanic Panic thing was, you know, now, of course, back then also the Lovecraft being a guy having been racist in the 1930s didn't get people up in arms about how terrible that was, you know. But my response to that, if you wanted to talk about it, is always the same, which is that in the first place, racism is a belief, not a crime. Therefore, the cure is education, not punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And my second statement, which is also accurate, is that Lovecraft got less racist over time, and that's the direction we want all racists to be, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure. Well, and his
stupid cat that everyone points out with the terrible name.
Yeah.
This was his cat when he was 9 years old.
Right.
That's when he had that cat. Yeah. I don't know if he even named it himself, right? But
right.
But if all of us were going to be plagued for our things we said when we were nine, then like we'd all be in jail for life, right?
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Sam especially, yeah.
One thing with Lovecraft, guilty too, that, I mean, if you read through Lovecraft's biography and you read about him, like, it's obvious Lovecraft was a guy that had a lot of issues. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah. Like, so...
But he brought it into, you know, it worked.
Yeah.
For his writing.
Right, and you know, I mean, it's almost like his intense fear of the other, right? That manifested so much in his life all over the place, almost really fueled the creation of this whole, you know, cosmic horror.
But it's concept. Also remarkable how rarely racist elements, I mean, they do appear in his stories, but they're not that common in the stories.
Right.
He doesn't feed them in. He has that in his belief in the back of his head, but then the story is about something else.
Well, right. You said in one of your videos that he was a racist of a scientific racist. What did you mean by that?
What I meant was, like right now, what we say is all humans are equal and there's no difference between us, right? Certainly all humans are of equal worth, right? But Lovecraft would have argued that there could be differences between us besides skin color and eye feature and hair. I don't believe he's correct in saying that there's great differences in terms of like temperament or intelligence. Or for example, Abraham Lincoln's take on it. Someone argued to him that blacks weren't as well educated or as smart as whites. And he said, that might be, but what you have to look at, this is Lincoln talking, not me, right? But he said, but you have to go by each individual. This black guy is smarter than this white guy. That makes him smarter, right? You don't go with all blacks are dumber than all whites because they're not, or all blacks are smarter. There's a range of both people.
Right.
There's diversity in thought.
There's diversity.
Exactly. Right?
And so you have to go by the individual. And that was his argument. And that's where racism fundamentally fails, is it's not going by the individual.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, well, I do love
more complex because humans aren't innately bad ever. So in my opinion.
Well, I do love your video you made for that specific question. Is H.P. Lovecraft racist?
So many kids, everyone loved that. They got
it got me because it had the timestamp on there for like a minute 30, almost 2 minutes long. And I'm like, okay, he's got this great explanation for it. And it's just, is H.P. Lovecraft racist? Yes.
Yep. Yes. we had all those credits to make it look like it was longer. And the credits are full of jokes, right? But
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's racist. And now can we move on and talk about If Cthulhu's Scary?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's just taking people with you know, as nuanced human beings, you know, like people have faults and they have failings and they have strengths and, you know, have things that they can contribute, you know, and it's complicated. And like you said, taking people as an individual and looking at a body of someone's whole entire life also, and not just taking a snapshot of where they were at one point and saying that's who that person was forever.
Yeah. Well, sure. You know, it's like the principle of like the Nazis would say that all Jews are bad, right? That was a principle they lived by. But like Lovecraft, in some of his letters, seems to have subscribed to that, except he married a Jew, right? And he had friends that were Jews, and he obviously didn't fully subscribe. And when he talked about it in his letters, he often said that the culture of people from Lebanon or in that area, Palestine, is not as awesome as Northern European culture, the mighty Vikings. And that's like, here's this guy that faints when it gets below 30 degrees outside. What a mighty Viking is him, right? But so I think it's kind of him trolling in his letters, right? Because obviously he couldn't walk the walk of being this mighty feud barbarian. I mean, this is a guy that wanted to be called Grandpa when he was in his 30s because he thought it was cool to be old. and he died young. Let's not forget that. He died at the age of 47. And he, like I said, he'd already tempered his beliefs by then. He may have done, if he'd lived another 20 years, which is completely plausible. I mean, I'm 20 years older than Lovecraft and I'm alive. So he could have done it.
Right.
Maybe not drinking a gallon of black coffee every day like he did. That might have been the problem.
Should have got on that word of wisdom train, huh?
Right. Right. I know.
As I stick to diet, Dr. Pepper is my vice of choice.
Damn. Where did being a fellow member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints here, where did you want to assume all you guys were? Well, where did you serve your mission?
Los Angeles.
Nice.
My wife served in Lisbon, Portugal.
Oh, no way. I served in Porto, Portugal.
Cool. She was there in from 76 to 78. And when she went, there weren't any other sister missionaries. So she had to like open up areas like by herself with a companion that didn't know anything.
Wow.
And that's always fun.
She also was raised in Chile until she was 11. I mean, she's not Chilean, she's American, but she was living there from the age of 5 to 11. So she speaks.
Right.
I say, you speak fluent Spanish. She says, I speak Spanish like an 11-year-old. She speaks Spanish. She sees Portuguese. She kind of gets them mixed up.
That's not hard.
And she took 6 years of French. So she speaks 4 languages.
That's awesome. Wow. Wow.
Which is awesome.
Way to catch. What a catch you got there.
Oh, I know. Like I said, my expensive trophy wife, right?
And I got one more question for you. Obviously we play Call of Cthulhu, and I'm sure you play tons of scenario written by other authors and stuff like that. Do you have a favorite Call of Cthulhu scenario, or at least one that particularly you enjoy that comes to mind real quick? Because we would love to play a Sandy Peterson recommended scenario in our show.
Or something you'd like to see.
I think a really strong scenario would be for Alex. I'm trying to think of the name of the scenario. I'll be right back in a second.
All right.
I have a very specific one for him to try.
Buckle up, Alex.
I know. I'm ready.
It's going to be like a 200-page scenario.
And you've already been committed. I mean,
You got to do this.
You have been challenged by Sandy himself. You have to do this.
We call this scenario the Keeper Crusher. I'm ready for this.
There it is. Guys.
Ooh, yeah.
I just bought that, actually.
Don't read it, Pete.
So here's the thing.
Pete literally bought that after you mentioned it.
Seth, so Alex, if you look on Seth's channel, you will see a article where he talks about how to use the scenario Panacea.
Okay.
In the very best way. I'm extremely proud of the scenario Panacea. He points out some things that would make it better for a keeper who's not me. And it's not a super long, it's like a couple nights tops. And okay. So tell your players not to look up that,
video. Yeah,
and I think Panacea is really good. One of the best scenarios I ever ran is also from this. These are like my top ones. Hotel Hell, which was really awesome because I played it. It was June 6th in 2006 in Germany. And I just finished a small game commission and they said, we want to play Call of Cthulhu with Sandy. So I put together a scenario that day. Okay. So they're playing it. And as they play it, like zombies are starting to rise up and they're like, oh, it was a Cthulhu scenario. I said, it is, don't worry about it. And they gradually realized that the entire Ring of Fire around the Pacific Ocean was starting to like unscrew and things were happening everywhere. There was giant monsters appearing and stuff. Where they were, there was this dead rising. And eventually I said, when is this happening? I said, it happens a week ago, our time. So it's like in June 1st. And then it came to a climax on June 6th. And at that point they realized that it's today and it's 6606. And it was the end of the world. And I can't really repeat that because it's not going to be 6606 for a while. But they like their minds were blown. It was a very effect. That was the scene I wanted to make them despair at the end while the horde of things from hell came pouring through the basement of the hotel they were working at. But that was a great moment in Call of Cthulhu when they realized that it was today and it was 666.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. That's
what. But Panacea has the advantage that Seth has some tips, and you can modify it yourself. You're probably as good a game master as Seth is, you know. But he's just very vocal and well spoken. And I think they will like that scenario. Yeah. It's modern.
I don't know about that.
Almost. He's talking about me, just to clarify.
About a medical company.
Right, yeah.
Almost all my stuff I play in modern times. There's a few I'll go with some other time period, but I don't have a regular thing happening in the 20s.
Cool. All right. Panacea, guys. That one's up and coming.
Anyway.
Let me know when you're doing that one because I want to hear that podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
I've only ever run it myself.
Right. Yeah. And what we do with our podcast too is we actually give it kind of the full audio drama treatment. So
cool.
We edit it. Music, sound effects. Like we spend a ton of time editing it up. So
nice. What do you use for your music?
We write a lot of our own.
Oh yeah.
We write a bunch of our own. As we've gone on the first like season, two seasons, most of that's all our own music. As we've gone on, I've just bought licenses for stuff that we can find. You know, Humble Bundle always will have these like game music packs on there, and I'll pick them up, you know, that are licensed for commercial use. So I'll grab those whenever I can. And Dark Fantasy Studios is one that has a lot of really solid stuff that we end up using.
But a lot of old horror movies are public domain and have creepy sounds.
Right.
One of my favorite things to play, of course, I don't have to worry about ownership when I play at home, is movies by the Italian band Goblin.
Yeah,
they're not movies, but songs by them. If you've heard of those guys,
I have.
That's an actual band name. The Goblin.
They're called Goblin. Amazing. They're from the 1970s and 80s, and they did most of the music for the great Italian horror of that time period.
Cool.
I check that out.
It's modern electronic sounding, but it's really creepy. It's like Suspiria, Deep Red, Tenebrae. Mm-hmm. A lot of Dario Argento's movies. And if you haven't seen Dario Argento's movies, then when I come to Utah, I will make you watch one.
Oh,
sounds good.
Yeah. You're there. Movie night, game night.
Dude. We're in.
And
I also watch you Haruko Goblin Hunter, which is super awesome Japanese movie. One of the characters is really obviously a Call of Cthulhu investigator.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Well, Sandy, and we don't want to keep you too long. We've already been, you know, longer than we'd even planned already. It's been awesome.
Having probably a little over an hour. So, but yeah. thank you for this time. I'm happy to do it again.
Absolutely. We're happy to have you on anytime.
We'd love to have you on.
You're up for it.
Maybe like said, if the Chaosium fails at Sanrol and does another Chaosium Con, you might show up there because there was a lot of people playing Call of Cthulhu at that place.
Yeah.
That'd be a blast.
And what's it called?
Chaosium Con.
Chaosium Con.
The name of the con, yeah. Donovan.
I know what the name is. I couldn't hear. Oh, never mind. I'm done. All right.
Sorry. I broke the rule.
Yeah, Sandy, you can probably tell that we're all brothers and, you know, like you said, the people you've been playing with for forever.
So, I don't know if you know this or not, but I actually produce, you know, the awesome figures I make for Cthulhu Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a figure line I'm doing using those figures for, it's the official Call of Cthulhu figure line. So I have done figures in PVC of almost every Lovecraftian monster, many of them never done before, like Glocky.
Wow, that's amazing.
Oh, nice.
That's awesome.
Do we pick those up on your website?
You can, yes. Awesome. You can also find them at better miniature market, places like that. But,
Great.
Oh, cool.
We love miniature market.
Yeah, yeah. That Christmas sale.
Too. Right, they buy a lot of stuff from us, so they're my heroes. Yeah. I mean, I like them for more than just that, but that, you know,
that helps.
It definitely helps.
That's always definitely a plus.
They always have a killer Black Friday sale every year.
Oh yeah, yeah. I always make myself poor on the miniature market Black Friday sale.
I'm saving. You tell your wife I'm saving so much money by spending hundreds of dollars.
The more you buy, the more you save.
In one scenario ever.
One thing I always actually do from that is I buy board games for my kids for Christmas and I kind of stock up and do a lot of that, and that's awesome. It's a ton of fun. I love doing that.
Well, we have a kids line at Peterson Games too, so. Games like Evacuate and
cool,
absolutely. Yeah, I was checking
out aboard a spaceship with alien monsters trying to escape.
Yeah. Oh, we have one big question about your products. The the sweet leather bound Cthulhu Mythos for 5e. When is that coming back? We want it.
You may have to find it on eBay.
Oh yeah, are you guys not doing another production of it?
I don't think we're going to do another production of it. No.
All right.
eBay it is.
I know. I just had the PDF because I was waiting for that to come in stock.
I'm doing the hardback, right? It's not made of goat skin, but it's still.
No, it was goat skin. I needed
was it really?
That. Yes.
Wow.
No way.
I needed that goat skin.
It turns out that goat skin is fairly inexpensive and, you know,
yeah.
Maybe because found in China. They lost the goats there.
it's probably just left over from some, you know, it's especially cheap if you got it left over from your sacrifices, right?
Yes.
Right. Well, awesome, Sandy. It's so good having you on. Anything you want to throw out here at the end? Projects you got coming up, things you're working on, things on the horizon you want
I'm working on about? A board game called Call of Cthulhu Terror Paths, which is essentially a board game reflecting the Call of Cthulhu experience, or actually, to be more precise, the climactic end scenario in a long campaign is what it usually is. And they're really varied. There'll be a map, like the Silver Twilight Lodge is one of the maps. And there's multiple scenarios that all happen in the lodge with different things. One of them, there's fungi from Yoggoth invading. One of them, there's a subsect of the lodge that's trying to evolve into Yogg-Sothoth. You know, there's the Forest of Resurrection, one of the other maps, where one of the adventures is there's a yellow sign rave in the woods. You have to go rescue the teenagers. But you're playing characters running through it as the doom mounts up. It's kind of my reaction to Arkham Horror, because Arkham Horror, though I like it and I actually worked on the first Arkham Horror, it always is kind of like not bland, but it's always kind of the same plot. But one of the things that's cool about Terror Paths is that when you start playing it, you literally don't know how to win the scenario. You have to figure it out as you play, which is I think interesting. So you're actually trying to explore and work things out and get the things you need as you go through, which I think is fun. And so that's something we have coming up.
That sounds awesome.
That sounds awesome.
And then we also have my space game Hyperspace for trying desperately to get out this year, which is cool because, as you know, Lovecraft's monsters, many of them are actually aliens.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So of the 25 alien species in Hyperspace, 5 of them are actually Lovecraftians, like old ones, Starspawn, fungi from Yoggoth, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be a Cthulhu flying through space.
Awesome.
Or, you know, one of the other 20 aliens, but
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. So listeners, our great Arkhamites, keep an ear out and eye out for those things coming down the pipeline. And thanks for listening. And Sandy, thanks so much for taking the time to spend with us on this. It's been just absolute blast. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Sandy.
We'll have Arthur contact you next time I come up.
Absolutely.
Sweet. Awesome.
Yeah. He's your connection, right?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. He's who we've been in contact with. Mm-hmm.
He's got the four granddaughters, the oldest of which has now played Call of Cthulhu. Nice.
Wait, how old is she?
12.
There you go.
A good age.
She did not play a super hardcore Call of Cthulhu. You know, it was for beginners.
Yeah.
Right.
I did play Call of Cthulhu with her, a very light Call of Cthulhu, which was based on the Al Adamson movie Blood of Ghastly Horror, which she really liked. So
awesome.
Cool.
So cool.
I got a lot of good movies to watch now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not a good movie. Blood of Ghastly Horror is not good.
But for us, that's almost even better. We love our crappy movies.
Yeah, we have a crappy movie. We used to do a crappy movie night and watch things like Bad Taste and Troll 2 and all that fun stuff.
Have you seen Brainiac?
No.
Brainiac. We haven't
seen that one. A Mexican movie from then it will change your life.
Yeah, we're writing that down.
It is so risible. Also, have you seen The Horror of Party Beach?
No.
Who's taking notes?
It's also
I got them down. I got Phantasm 2, So I Married a Monster from Outer Space. Brainiac. What was the last one you just said?
The Horror of Party Beach. It's a combination of underwater monsters and beach blanket party. One of my favorite moments is when the monsters have risen up and attacked a slumber party full of teenage girls, and they've killed 20 of them. Okay. And the main girl, who's the heroine, didn't go to the slumber party for some reason. And then the next day she's sad because 20 of her friends have been eaten by monsters. And her boyfriend says, "Well, how long are you going to mope around? Let's go do something." And then she goes, "Okay." And this is the morning after. What a boyfriend, right? So that was pretty great. Also, it turns out the underwater monsters explode when they're exposed to silicon, which I guess makes sense.
This is right up our alley.
Oh, man. That's a movie that would never work now.
It is highly entertaining. And I will also recommend, if you haven't seen it, The Brain That Wouldn't Die.
I love that. Sweet. Just because of the name.
Which is just barking mad and great.
Brain that wouldn't die. I got it.
Check them out. Let me know what you think. And then I'll show you some actually scary things when I show
up. Maybe we should do a whole series of Sandy Peterson's
recommendations for movies.
Reviews.
Arkham Files. Watches Sandy Peterson's reviews. Movie list.
On my website, I had a series for a while saying Great Obscure Horror, where I talked about 10 obscure horrors, not all of them movies, but some of them movies. Actually, one of them, what I suggested, and it was mostly because I have non-American fans, I recommended like Spook Alleys and Haunted Houses. Because most Europeans have no idea that those exist in America and that they're pretty great, actually.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Well, yeah, thanks a ton, dude. Like, this has been really, I'm really new to this game. The first time I played the game was when I was recording our first scenario, Mr. Corbett.
The way to go in. Go in cold.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how to do it.
And we did.
Oh, my gosh. I was so excited about it.
It was, I never did anything D&D. I never had any tabletop RPGs. I mean, I love video game RPGs, but this was the first tabletop I did. And it brings a whole nuance to my adult life, which is, I'm finding more rare to have nuance in your life because you're not a kid to have all the magic. Everything's new to them. And so thanks for doing that. Thanks for putting this together. I don't mean to be cheesy or anything, but it's been
I never grew up, right? So
good company.
You're one of the lucky ones.
The only full-time job I've had ever has been a game designer. So I have no idea. So I assume that's a really weird life, but I don't have any other life to compare it to. Mm-hmm. So
it's awesome. Want to be a mailman? We got some job openings.
I mean, probably the walking around would do me good, you know. But then my company would go under. So
go.
So no dice.
No, yeah. Oh, well, I was this close to getting Sandy Peterson to work for the post office.
No.
Mood meaning to the word going postal. Yeah.
He's just gonna turn it into a new game.
I look forward to meeting you in person someday.
Yes.
And Yog-Sothoth Neblod Zin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Arkham Files. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Seriously, the conversation was a few days ago, and I'm still kind of geeking out about it. Keep an eye and ear out for our D&D Mythos session. It will be out soon. But while you're waiting, go over and check out our website at www.arkhamrpg.com. We have some cool merch there available for purchase. Sign up for Patreon at www.patreon.com/TheArkhamFiles for rad bonus content and an invite to our exclusive Gilded server. Check out our social media pages as well on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And last but definitely not least, go check out Sandy's products at www.petersongames.com. Go buy Sandy Peterson's Cthulhu Mythos for 5e and Pathfinder. Go buy his other games. They're awesome too. Thanks again for listening. We will see you all soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.